Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Aparuta de sangamatasa taura ye sorvanta bamunjantu satang. Evening. I'm personally suffering a kind of state of shock because of I suppose you're aware of the news of the terrorist attacks in the United States. And so this is probably the, you know, quite a horrific. And we've been sitting here looking at the stuff that goes on in our mind. Unknown attacks on the World Trade Building in New York City. Two commercial airplanes were flown into them. And it would be 2 o'clock British time, and another plane crashed into the Pentagon. Oh. These all commercial airplanes, hijacked airplanes. So this is, and then another plane, or 4 planes, one crashed outside of Pittsburgh. And so the United States now is on a red alert. And Britain also is on a Amber Alert. I just notice the effect this has on you. The World Trade Towers were two towers in one building. It's one of the tallest buildings in the world, 110 stories. So the first plane was aimed directly at suicide attacks, and the first plane aimed at about the 80th story, and then sort after another flew into it, and then eventually both buildings collapsed. And this was about 9 o'clock in New York in the morning. So this is, we realize that the results of this are going to also be rather frightening, because they're really, of course, talking very tough, and but there's nobody. And nobody knows who really did it. And there are no terrorist groups claiming that they're responsible. And it's very kind of extraordinarily well-planned attack, because it was synchronized in a way that, you know, to hijack airplanes is, to be able to do it in such a kind of skillfully planned way. Because this is a very frightening event, you know, the kind of worldwide repercussions. And of course the reaction, the official reactions are very, bravado and the President of the United States and Tony Blair and all come forth, you know, saying we're not going to let them get away with this. Just thoroughly understandable in terms of our human reactions. And so, you know, like the Middle East crisis, you know, with the Israelis and Palestinians, you see the inevitability of continued suffering where revenge is part of one's emotional makeup. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth reaction. I think we can all understand that. Like, I'm certainly, I can feel desire for revenge when somebody has attacked me or my family or whatever. But because of the, you know, the practice of meditation and the kind of contemplation of existence, to realize how to act on, you know, to perpetuate revenge. Like in Northern Ireland, is it hopeless unforgivingness and seeking to get even with the Protestants and the Catholics. It is important to consider, you know, in just, you know, in our, because this is part of our humanity, we're all quite capable of performing vengeful acts, seeking revenge, and desire to make those who suffer, who made us suffer, or those who have humiliated us to humiliate them. And it goes on and it ends up with what, destruction as a, and a kind of ongoing feeling of wanting to seek revenge. And then where does it stop? I remember this etching I saw of the French artist Daumier, of this battlefield where there's nothing left, just, you know, a few broken trees and everybody's dead. And there's a skeleton sitting, leaning against the log, and it says, it was a sign across his front saying, peace. Is this all we're capable of? Just keep it going till we're all dead is the way to peace. Then you can even understand, you know, that both sides, in a way, when terrorism must come from, you know, a total frustration of various groups or people who feel they've been humiliated and demeaned and ignored and persecuted. And we see like a superpower that, especially at the present time, does not have any great concern for the core elements of our planet. And and how easy it is to blame a powerful country or one's poverty or misery. And so, you know, we can justify terrorist acts because even though the United States calls them, calling them names, cowards, and using all kinds of vilifying words to describe these people who committed this act. So what does that do, you know, just to call them names, because this is a natural reaction to want to make them, you know, the force of evil in the world. But I think the more we meditate, the more we're aware we're interconnected, you know, this isn't just one side against another, but in some ways we're all in this together, and it's a way of a more visionary way of trying to understand rather than just taking sides. And myself, coming from affluent country, I don't have really any kind of understanding of what it's like to be, you know, like be brought up in a way that is where you're constantly fed, this resentment and hatred. There's a kind of, like you can understand, like Palestinians, some of them have for several generations have lived in kind of refugee camps and been brought up to hate and resent. And these suicide bombers, this is another strange thing where you actually are willing to kill yourself. And, you know, to hijack a commercial airliner that's full of passengers, and willing to kill all of those people along with yourself. For what reason? You know, why would anyone want to do that? So, I can't speak from my own experience, but in terms of, if I notice, like in my own background, being brought up in a kind of privileged circumstance, I've never felt inferior on a sense of racial, as a race. That was never. We're always, in some ways, if you're white and Christian in my generation in the United States, you're the best. But I remember when I was in university and I was would work in the summertime to make extra money, and so one job I took on was working in a tea cannery in Washington State, where I'm from. And so one of my duties was to load boxes of canned peas, Green Giant peas, on a pallet. You know, it was a pretty simple job. And the man that worked with me was a kind of itinerant laborer, you know, one of these American black that kind of traveled around to various parts, wherever, you know, picking fruit or working in canneries or whatever. And I was then only about 18 years old. He was, must have been the mid-30s or something, and we became very good friends. We kind of bonded in our mutual working situation, helping each other. And I remember I was quite naive, 18-year-old, quite, you know, inexperienced with life and idealistic and naive. And so, and coming from the Northwest, from Seattle, it was never a kind of racially fraught place. You know, it was, we had a large black community that especially migrated there during the Second World War to work in the Boeing's aircraft of the shipyards. And there were quite large Chinese-Japanese communities, but racial discrimination wasn't particularly, it existed in subtle forms, but nothing like the American South. My parents were very much against any kind of racial discrimination. So whenever, you know, come home from school and say, and you pick up kind of not very nice words referring to various races, my mother would say, you should never use those words because they're contemptuous. You should never use contemptuous words towards others. And so that really stuck, you know. I appreciated that as I grew older. I could see how that helped, just to get it from your parents, some kind of guidance in regard to such issues. Because some of my own friends' parents were racist, did have racial prejudices, and I remember feeling quite repelled by it. And because the golden rule, being brought up as a Christian, the golden rule is do unto others as you would have others do unto you. So my mother had always, you know, get me to reflect on this. If I was unkind to the cat or did something that wasn't very nice, and she'd say, would you want somebody to treat you like that? And I'd say no, and then she said, well, yeah, then don't do it to others. And it was a reflection, you know, that's quite a good reflective teaching. And you can see children are quite capable of reflection, because I don't think I was a specially gifted child, but they definitely, it did sink in, you know. But that's been a guideline for much of my life, is you know, to be malicious and cruel, intentionally cruel towards others or to animals or whatever. I would always remember, would I want to be treated, you know, it's not that I never felt these kind of emotions, but in terms of reflecting on action, you know, it was, it did commit me to a way of you know, not acting on such negative or impulses as I might be feeling. So that's it can be kind of hackneyed phrase in the English language, the golden rule, but also is a very powerful reflective statement. And because of that, then it's oftentimes been difficult for me to understand how people can do horrible things to each other. You know, it's seeming without any kind of remorse or consideration of the pain they're causing to the people they're abusing, or the animals that they exploit or take advantage of. But yet, if I'd been brought up in some minority group that felt abused, what would I be like? You know, if my parents had fed me a diet of, you've got to, you know, say those people have humiliated us, abused us, taken our land, destroyed our culture, all that, and then, and we can't let them get away with it, then I don't know if that was the message I was getting. And this black man that I worked with, you know, we became quite good pals. And so I said one evening, let's go and have a meal in the town restaurant. And he said, oh, no, I can't go. I said, why? He said, oh, I can't go in those restaurants, in those cafes. And why? He said, oh, you black people can't go in. And I couldn't go in with you. And I could see, you know, just his whole response was, you know, it never occurred to me because that was would be a problem. And I remember being quite moved by that he was someone who knew that he didn't have that sense of, well, I can go anywhere, you know. I don't have any problems. Even when I'm in foreign countries, I feel, you know, I can go anywhere. And I don't have a particular feeling of that I'm going to be persecuted. I remember being in Japan after, in the military, after the war, Second World War, and I went with a group of Japanese to see the war museum in Nagasaki, because we're one of the naval bases that our ship would dock at was a port. This is after the Korean War, was a port in the southern island of Kyushu, and the port was Sasebo. It was easy ride on a train to Nagasaki. And so I was in a sailor's uniform with these Japanese friends, and we went to the museum where they have all the relics of the atomic bomb. And as I was looking at all these photographs of these, burned, horribly disfigured people and relics, you know, like one was a stone with somebody's handprint that had been melted into it was so hot that a stone melted and it left this handprint of somebody's hand in it, and other kind of grisly things that were taken and put in this museum. And I suddenly had this incredible, overwhelming paranoia. That's so obvious, you know. In American naval uniform and towering above everybody else, this big American cloak. There's no way I couldn't hide myself in the crowd. It seems to be the story of my life. And so I said to this friend, I said, you know, I'm really sorry about this. You know, I feel so guilty. And the friend said, oh, well, that was, you know, that was years ago. You know, we don't feel anything, you know. So it was, I wasn't getting hostile looks either. It wasn't that any people were, you know, the people in the museum were looking at me in a hostile way, but it was a sense of being part of something that was very cruel and destructive to masses of quite innocent people, you know, because bombing doesn't select. And also, this is what happened like in the World Trade Center, isn't it? It's like these enormous buildings. They say it's one of the tallest in the world. At 9 o'clock in the morning, everybody's, you know, probably there for working. And in the financial district of Manhattan, and one of the kind of landmark, kind of American monuments, and this enormous building suddenly collapsing. And they even have pictures of people, you know, jumping out of the windows, or this building just kind of crumbling down, filled with living people in it. And so these are the, you know, this kind of revenge and this destructiveness. Who really gets who gets destroyed? Oftentimes the innocent you know, quite innocent bystanders. And yet, our society still promote these kind of actions, you know. I mean, we're quite, you know, America's record is not all that pure either in terms of being responsible for bombings and napalming and destroying in the sense of when you see somebody as the enemy, and then you being able to label that a group is the enemy, you don't see their humanity anymore. So we can be conditioned, you know, like war propaganda. You've got to make the people you're fighting into demons and monsters so that killing them, it seems like the right thing to be doing. So I remember during the Second World War, the propaganda that I grew up during the Second World War, and the propaganda was all to make the Germans and Japanese into monsters. So I remember feeling this, you know, they had posters, lurid posters. I remember one, still, I can still visualize this horrid poster of this kind of barbed wire and these kinds of Nazis are dragging a woman off into a dark alley. And then this is what's going to happen if they take over our country. And, you know, then you think of, when you're a little boy, think of your mother, and you think, they're going to do that to my mother. And this is a way of, you know, kind of justifying the bombing and the vengeful acts, and in a sense of being right, of God is on our side. This is what we have to do. So this is war propaganda. Is like that. You have to make out the enemy as subhuman or demonic. And then the only thing left, you know, then you feel righteous in your attacks, in your vengeful attacks, and destroying them. Notice in the Buddha's teaching, what in the Four Noble Truths, it points to dukkha or suffering, which is a common human experience. And so, you know, this, if you think of all human beings suffer, then you're looking at it in a different way. It's hard to imagine these monstrous enemies as suffering in any way. You've got to make them suffer in some way, you know, like harming them or getting even, persecuting them, torturing them, make them suffer. You don't think that they suffer. If you start thinking of them as just like your own, you know, another human being that suffers, you wouldn't be able to really harm them that much. You know, there would be an influence in which you'd feel compassion. Just here in Britain a few years ago, this James Bulger case where this little boy was brutally murdered by two other little boys up in the north, and they arrested the two boys. They were only the little boy that was murdered was three years old or something like that, and the other two boys kind of kidnapped him from a supermarket, and they were older, maybe 9 or 10, something like that, and they did a kind of atrocious act. And then they were put in prison, and now there you can see the parents of the little boy that was murdered. Now these boys are now, I think they're late teens or whatever, and the government wants to let them out to kind of free them from the prison. And of course, to do this, they have to completely change their names and identities and so forth, because there's still this revengefulness in this country wanting to get even with them. And the parents of the James Bulger, the mother especially, wants them to be locked up in prison for a whole lifetime. You know, there's no compassion for the murderers of her own son, and only wants to see them suffer. So this, you think, I can understand this, you know, I mean, I'm on one level of, you know, thinking what they've done is so terrible that they should pay a price for it by being locked up their whole life. Or use the more reflective mind begins to see the two boys, I don't know who they are and what they were like, but this was a horrible thing they did. But, you know, give them a chance, because there's so many other factors to consider. And so you have a more liberal sense of, you know, concern and compassion, rather than just taking a blind stand of revenge, hatred, and condemnation. And to be able to forgive, isn't it? To be able to recognize, and even if we do atrocious acts, that in itself, the suffering of that is worse than being killed. I mean, from what I know now, I'd rather be killed than kill somebody. I'm going to die anyway someday. It's a matter of time. But I wouldn't want to have to carry the memories of having brutalized and killed anybody with me, even if I could live, you know, never get caught, no one would ever know, and have everything, have become wealthy and successful, and then I'd still have that to remember, is that those things hang around you. They're whether you're punished or not by the civil law or by the society, you punish yourself because you have to remember it. So I think I'd rather be killed than kill. In Buddhism, we have, you know, we contemplate this law of karma a lot, and it's a simple kind of cause and effect thing. To do good, you receive good. To do bad, you receive bad. So then people come up and they say, well, I know this man that lived, I don't believe in that law of karma, because I know a man, he's never done anything good for anybody. He's the most awful kind of criminal, brutish male, and yet he's wealthy, has beautiful houses all over the world, big cars, gorgeous mistresses, and he gets invited to all the important functions wherever he goes, received at Buckingham Palace, he's living extraordinarily well. You know, he's not suffering, yet he's done terrible things. And so we equate that being wealthy and successful as some kind of reward. Or is it? You know, when you think of it, if you're wealthy and famous and all that, and yet you have, you know, you've acquired it through criminal acts, you know, there'd be a lot of fear, you know, a lot of paranoia. Wherever you went, you'd always have the furies, in the Greek sense, you know, these furies that pursue you wherever you are. You can't get away from them. Or living as a Buddhist monk, where you, you know, you live as an alms mendicant, and you don't have any money, any property, and yet you practice meditation, and so you have a lot of joy and happiness in your mind. You don't have fear and paranoia on that level. The Furies are not a problem for me. Even though the unskillful acts that I have done, you know, which were not all that much in terms of my unwholesome acts were usually through naivety, heedlessness, stupidity, but never through, I don't think I've been malicious. I don't find any joy in harming or seeing others suffer. The unskillful acts of my life have given me enough guilt to where I know if I did anything more than that, I wouldn't be unbearable. Because the real reward is a clear mind, isn't it? This clarity is a peace, not through Daumier's etching, but in terms of having inner peace. Because the power of your practice more and more as you trust in it and cultivate awareness, then you find that your true nature is peaceful. You know, when you get to beyond yourself, beyond the conditioning of your mind, beyond the greed, hatred, and delusion, and the various identities and so forth that you might have, hang-ups you might have on as a person, when you get beyond that, then I find that stillness and peacefulness, purity. So just noting that is, is the result. If we direct our attention to what is skillful and developing a life that we respect, you know, like in monastic life, for example, I really respected people who were willing to live in the restrained way of Buddhist monks and nuns. And so by putting myself into it, then I began to feel a lot more self-respect. Because I lived in a way that I respected. When I lived more in a kind of way of just indulging my greedy appetites, and impulses, and I began to lose self-respect. Even though I was having lots of fun doing in this libertine style that I thought would be liberating, I ended up feeling a lot of self-contempt and hatred to myself. So then, in moving into a monastic form, I found increasing sense of what we can might consider self-respect. So just noting, you know, how things work on us. This is just from my own experience. So I can't, I'm not speaking for anyone else, but this has been tested and tried by my own life. You know, see what brings me joy and peace, and what makes me lose self-respect. And then the choice is obvious. You know, it's not being imposed on me by a puritanical system that says, you know, you're going to hell if you don't keep all the rules, and if you don't behave yourself, on Judgment Day, you'll be sent down to the Avicii hell, unmitigated misery forever. Because in Buddhist cosmology, you've got different hell realms. And at the bottom, at the pits of it, is called Avicii hell. And that's where it's eternal and unmitigated. You don't, in other hells, there's moments that aren't so bad. But Avicii, it's total misery, one moment after another. So, I mean, that's the cosmology, cosmological view. But also in Buddhism, you know, Avicii hell is anicca dukkha anatta, just like any other condition. So it just seems eternal. I mean, if you ever fall into it, it seems like it's never going to stop. You know, it's forever. But actually, it's not really. In the Wheel of Life, this Tibetan model where they have this Wheel of Life with the six realms of existence in it, and then they have this, you know, the highest realm is the one that's kind of ethereal realm, is the Deva realm, where they show kind of people that are very beautiful, and they play music, and everything is just light and beauty. And pleasure. And then there's the Asura realm, which is the jealous titans, the jealous gods, and they're powerful gods. They're gods, they're not demons, but they're ambitious and they're jealous. They're always so jealous of the devas, and they're always trying to fight with the devas, and they can't stand to see people so beautiful and happy and so refined, and they're obsessed with power. And then in the human realm is the a lot of people like us, human beings, who we can kind of reach these states. We can have moments of titanic ambition, Asura-like behavior. You can see it no doubt in the business world and so on, where British politics, you know, where you want the power, and you, anyone who's more powerful, you want to knock them down. You're jealous of the rich, the privileged people, because you want to take away their money and their privileges and so forth. It's certainly, you know, not uncommon mental state within the human beings that I've known. And then, but we also can sink into the lower realms. We can become just like the beyond the lower realms include like the animal realm, where your main interests are procreation, eating and sleeping. And that's a bit dull, you know. And it's survival of the fittest, you know. You have one animal preying on another. Then, and we can, you know, many human beings develop more like that. Now, their lives are pretty much food, sex, and sleep. So then below that are the pretas, and they're hungry ghosts, and they're symbolized by they have these huge bellies, like as big as Mount Everest, enormous bellies, and they've got this little skinny neck and tiny little head with a mouth. The mouth is as big as the eye of a needle, you know, it's very tiny. And so they've got to fill this belly, this enormous belly, through this tiny little mouth, this long neck. And of course, everything, you put anything in, and you can't never get enough. And so you're always hungry. So you live your life just trying to, you know, to stem this hunger, this insatiable hunger, and this burning, and the food you do take has to go down this long, skinny neck. Everything burns down through it. That's quite, quite unpleasant realm to be born into. And then below that is a hell realm with fire and brimstone and all the rest. And then they have a Buddha for each of these realms. You know, they put a Buddha in each realm, what they learn from. So in the Deva realm, the Buddha, you know, I think is playing an instrument. And in the Asura realm, he's got another, something else to and then in the human realm, he has an alms bowl. He's a monk with an alms bowl. And then, this symbolizes the Buddhist take on fulfilling humanity is through humility and being responsible for conduct and you're in this mid realm where you can just, you know, I can identify with all these realms through my own experience. I've seen certain preta-like qualities, certain demonic ones, certain deva ones, the titanic asura ones, animal type feelings and moods. It's not that I, you know, cannot relate or empathize with these different, but in the human realm, because we have like as a deva, you have an ethereal body, you don't have a coarse body like this. So how nice that would be. I used to long to have an ethereal body. You know, that you could live on refined substances like ether, and you didn't have to defecate or do any of these awful things that our bodies do, you know. And you could and you didn't smell bad, or, you know, you did always this kind of perfume emanating off you for all the fragrance, and everything's so nice and pretty and beautiful, refined, and your body is that way. It's not doesn't get tired, it doesn't ever smell bad, and never hungry, and just have this lovely, lovely appearance. Don't get old either. So, you know, that was kind of like, I think many, many modern fashions and modern life is an attempt to kind of create the illusion that we're devadas, you know, to always present ourselves in this kind of refined style of glamour and beauty, because we are quite embarrassed oftentimes by the coarseness of our own bodies, and it oftentimes humiliates us. If you've ever, you know, if you've worked with old people, or, you know, you lose control over your cum incontinent. I think how humiliating that would be to always be wetting the bed when you're 80 years old, or unable to control your things, and how embarrassing and how humiliating that can be for people. My father suffered enormously. It was humiliating that when he lost control, take care of his own body. But in this human body, we are like an animal's body, isn't it? It's not that much different. So we can relate well to animals, because our bodies are animal bodies. So we have, we're not that much different from chimpanzees, monkeys and things like this, and even dogs. You know, why do people love dogs so much? Now, what is it about dogs that humans like? Well, I find this is my dogs have emotions similar to humans. You know, so you can express emotion and And dogs are quite receptive, and they have. You can hurt their feelings, and they get jealous, and they... and we can relate to all that, you know, to the... They can become naughty and devilish, and they can become very loving. And so, you know, we can, on the level of sharing that realm, we find a kind of common bond with say, dogs, cats, horses. In Thailand, probably with elephants. The people, when they keep elephants, we get quite attached to them. It'd be hard to have an elephant do it. And pretas, you know, I've seen the preta side of myself, the hungry ghost. You know, like when you're just obsessed with the things. You know, alcoholism or sexual obsessions or drug addiction or things like this. You get into kind of preta realms of feeling just obsessed with this endless striving to have more because you never get enough. And you just have to have more. And you always, you know, the moment of satisfaction is so brief that you're always on the next one, trying to get something more. And then the pits of hell, isn't it? Depression and just the total despair and these kind of things where we just sink into a hopeless state, or like a beachy hell where there's no hope. When you're depressed, isn't it? You feel you're going. There's no way out. You're so low, so down that you can't. There's no light at the end of the tunnel. There's no hope at all. It seems like forever. And once you start having hope, then the depression starts lifting because hope is quite a positive. Anyway, see a dim light at the end of the tunnel gives you a direction. Well, these are just ways of contemplating these different levels that as human beings we can relate to. It's not that we're so refined that we can't relate to the lower realms. And yet we can... you know, really feel a sense of, you know, we can also be very arrogant in the sense that we feel we're much better than the animals and we can, you know, the realms of suffering we can ignore when we're living comfortable lives like Devadas. You know, that you can see in terms of living in affluent Western countries like this one how little the poverty of other countries affects us. You know, how we read about it, we hear about it, but we don't have to even see it, really. And we can, and our own life is a realm where we can just take for granted so many things of security and comfort, privileges, rights, and so forth. That we oftentimes take for granted, and yet when you've gone to see, you know, in countries that have a lot of poverty, it's the kind of just scraping together, just trying to get enough food to feed your family, one of the, you know, basic needs that some of these people have to spend their whole life just trying to find enough to get one meal or something to eat, for not just for oneself but for one's family. And so they're like a terrorist attack, and it's easy to condemn such things because it is a stupid thing to have done, in a cruel and an atrocious act not to deny that. But also, another part of me considers, you know, people driven to such acts, why do they perform such acts? And in my own life, you know, I've never been driven to do such things. You know, I've never been pushed to the point where I would do something like that, or even something lesser, some kind of violent act of revenge. So reflecting on this is the reflectiveness. We began to have a much more compassionate understanding of the human condition. And this is very much what's needed at this time, because the gap between the rich and poor is increasing. And the United States, of course, represents the ultimate success story. The biggest economy, the most wealthy country, and where it's a symbol, isn't it, everywhere as the only superpower, they say, that's left. Well, then this, of course, this brings up jealousy, hatred, blame, you know, from those who don't have such privileges or such opportunities. You can see now just the movement of refugees and asylum seekers, you know, just trying, these Afghanis that are trying to find a place to live, you know, and they live in Afghanistan is another hell realm, it seems. This Taliban government is really sick. and at least from the news I hear, and the people trying to survive and trying to get someplace, and they're trying to get to Australia, where they've been refused entrance. And some of them have been allowed onto this island, Nauru, or some little coral atoll in the Pacific. But I think it's a great producer of fertilizer. and how unwilling, you know, affluent countries are and how we don't want all these poor people coming into our country, because it's going to be a nuisance to us, isn't it? They cause trouble. They're probably not even educated, and I don't know. Like we can find so many reasons about, you know, not wanting to let these people in because they're Muslims. they'll just be a burden on us and things like this. So we want to protect what we have and our standards of, and I understand that too. But now, just reflecting on from the sense of the first noble truth of dukkha, then more and more, one I find myself just thinking only for myself and my own group somehow diminishes when I contemplate the natural condition that we all share. And I saw this years ago. I saw this book of photographs, of war photographs, and I forget what it was called. Was it from the Biafra War in Africa? I think it was in the 50s. And it showed this black woman, bare-chested, and her breasts were all just shriveled up, completely dry. And she was holding this little baby who was trying to nurse on these dried-up breasts. And this woman, you know, with such kind of anguish and bewilderment in her eyes, and this little, it's like a Madonna in a way, you know, of a mother and child. And I think especially women can relate to that, you know, of just the futility, the sadness of a woman, just an ordinary woman who's trying to nurse her own baby and is so starved herself that she can't even produce any milk. And there's something so pathetic and sad when you look at that photo of this human condition, of how, you know, that people, human beings like ourselves, begin to see a common humanity rather than, well, this black woman or, you know, this African woman, how we can dismiss because she's not one of us, not like us. Or when we look at the common ground of dukkha, its causes, and the possibility for cessation, and a way of living that, you know, that we've, that of non-dukkha, that we very much have the opportunity to practice, to hear, to develop in this way. But before you can really meditate, you at least have to have enough to eat. Now, it wouldn't be any good for me to go start a kind of retreat center in a place where everybody's starving to death. Basically, we need the material food before we can really take meditation that seriously. However, once we meditate, then, if, you know, I think I could handle starvation now. At least I have developed skills in how to deal with physical deprivation or pain, things like this. I'm not, you know, I would know. I have some insight on how to deal with where if life goes in a certain way in which I'm persecuted, abused, or, you know, poverty-stricken, starving to death. I have skills that I can use in understanding and reflecting, in which I would, you know, hopefully not create the anger and resentment and blame that I would do if I didn't have these skills. Book written by this Tibetan Lama who was, I think, in a prison in Tibet, Paladin Getsu, yeah, and he was, how many years in a, 33 years, he was incarcerated in a Chinese prison and was, you know, beaten and tortured, you know, almost every day. And he managed to get out eventually and came, he's written a book and got on lecture tours, but somebody asked him, what is the thing that most frightened you when you were in the prison being tortured and brutalized? And he says, my biggest fear that I might lose my compassion for my torturer. So that's very moving to me. he didn't either. He managed to, you know, to get out without losing that. So we can see that potential in ourselves, you know, and we, you know, how, you know, if we have this strength that comes from this understanding, from wisdom, from knowing the Dhamma, from having a confidence in awareness and being able to understand the suffering of our enemies or the people torturing us. This is possible. This isn't something that is impossible to encourage the human beings like ourselves to move in that direction. At least that's the way I want to move. Don't know what I'd do if people started torturing me. But I've worked on just the torture I get living here at Amravati. So it's not, you know, people aren't doing physical tortures on me, but just working with the irritations, frustrations, and that the problems of living in a community. You know, I think I start on that level, some way that I can, you know, before they nail me to a cross or put me on the rack. Oh, if I can just learn to deal with my hurt feelings, my disappointment, my irritation, frustration in this community, and see that is at least, you know, working on just that level of what's actually happening to me, rather than waiting for the big moment when they nail me to the cross. They may never nail me to a cross, but, you know, so at least I hope they never do. They'll put me on the rack, but at least, you know, on just the nitty-gritty frustrations and hurts and that of daily life. Even you're living in a monastic community of very good people. You know, we live in, we're all kind of here. We're all here to practice, and we're all very kind of morally trustworthy, and basically we all aspire and want to be good. And yet, in spite of that, even though you're living in a community where all the members are basically good spiritual practitioners, there's enough here to be bloody irritating. And there's enough that goes on to be hurt and offended and upset and fed up and averse. And so this, you know, I decided to work with the way my life is rather than I did go to Tibet a couple of years ago, and fortunately they didn't incarcerate me, but they kicked me out of Tibet. The Sugato, the other monk, and that was heartrending. And we traveled with this group, the six lay people from England, and then these Sherpas, and we'd been trekking in through Nepal for quite a few days, and you're moving closer to Mount Kailash, and it's so beautiful, you know, you're in this beautiful kind of wilderness in the Himalayas. We had got into Tibet, and then at the immigration station, they said, no monks allowed, and then we were taken by armed guard back to them in a Land Rover, crushed into a Land Rover with several other armed guards, and chucked out on the border with two Sherpas. And this tremendous grief, you know, and we left, and with the six lay people we were traveling with, and even the Sherpas, everybody was in tears. You know, it's like being ripped apart, you know. This kind of goal, we're all going to Mount Kailash, and we've been through a lot of hard work, you know, climbing up mountains and all that in the high altitudes, and you kind of easily bond in such situations, and then suddenly ripped apart. And of course, I was the whole focus of this pilgrimage. It was because of me that all the others left. So it was even more kind of grief, feeling of grief. But that gave me a chance to work with that, isn't it? This is, you know, I can survive that. Work with what happens rather than, you know, that was an extreme one. But daily life in Amravati also gives me enough practice, practical situations to be able to transcend them, to learn, to forgive, to understand, to have compassion, develop compassion. So that's enough for this evening, and now that you know that it's going to be interesting what the United States will do. And that's frightening, you know, because of the power there, of that country. And you know, the incredible weapon power of that country is very frightening. And you know that if how they're going to use, what they're going to do is you know, it's too new, and nobody's saying, but one feels only trepidation around that, because they're not into forgiving, the Americans.
What do you think of the American reaction?
It's been very kind of get 'em. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's understandable, you know. It's a big shock. I mean, we're going to get you, you know. But they don't even know who they're after yet.
You said it's
completely collapsed.
You've got 10,000 people living there.
Yes.
And the Pentagon.
The Pentagon, a part of it is supposed to be still on fire. Was the plane flew into the one side of the Pentagon, and the whole country is on red alert, and there's no flight to the United States.
I have a daughter that lives in Manhattan, which is 67.
She didn't work in the world.
67.
World Trade Center is down in the financial district, isn't it?
It's quite near there.
Is it? I don't know. But I mean, the building itself, it didn't seem to harm so much the area. They don't know how two planes even could make a building kind of implode. And so they suspect there might even have been bombs in the building itself.
They have an estimate
as to
how many people were killed.
They don't, you know, it's just unknown. They're not saying, they're not even on the news, they won't say.
They don't think it's that because it's
too smart.
It's too well planned, and I don't think. And Yasser Arafat said no, it was not. It had nothing to do with it. But also, they were celebrating it in the Gaza Strip. You know, particularly wise thing to be doing. And they were in America. I heard of one was the United Airlines, another was American Airlines, and I think two were Emirates.
And I just saw them.
And Tony Blair has stopped all plane traffic over London now. Relief.
Staggering thing, because in America normally there's such a high level of paranoia, sort of what we would regard as very minor terrorist incidents spark off this wave of paranoia, but something of this scale, you know, and hitting the Pentagon,
yeah,
the World Trade Towers, it's just staggering as to how America will respond to that.
Nobody can touch one at all, you know, very well protected. And now, I think they just did it to disrupt his retreat. I'll stop giving retreats. Right? Thanks, but I'm not giving it. I know what it's called. That's one way of looking at it, though, isn't it? One shocking event, I remember it wasn't on a chart years ago. I was invited to give a retreat, 10-day retreat at Wat Pananachat. And I started out in the evening, the first evening, and I said, gave my introductory kind of reflection. I said, you know, we're all here in a safe place, and you know, no storms, no tornadoes, no earthquakes. We can count on just having a peaceful time. So our practice is to just be mindful, meditate. And that very night, they had an incredible windstorm, a cyclone. And it blew down some of the houses in the village. And in the kutia, the hut I was staying in, I could feel the wind keep lifting it up, you know. I thought it was going to be blown over. So I've never said that again. People